These were people who simply could not imagine doing any evil to anyone. People who liked eating well, drinking, even smoking. Who enjoyed playing the violin, in one case, and tennis, and driving luxurious cars and executive airplanes, in the 1970s, when very few people in Italy could own a personal plane. They lived most of the time in their huge underground bases, but some of them lived among us, inside our society, playing every kind of role in it. One was a university researcher, another one the manager of a rather important textile company in the center of Italy, a third one was a senior manager in one of the largest German telecommunications, TLC, companies, and so on. It was an explicit decision by the Amicizia people to keep everything concealed under the strictest secrecy, and there were very good reasons for that. Actually, once in a while something would emerge publicly, but always in a vague and uncertain way. Many European scholars were aware that something was happening. But nobody, outside our group, has ever had even the slightest idea of how big and how important it all was. 1. We had direct, face-to-face meetings with the Friends, also called W56, who are extraterrestrials coming both from planets in our own galaxy, and, from other galaxies. A participant who prefers to remain anonymous told researcher Nicola Dupa in 2008. Here on Earth they reached the maximum number of 200, living inside underground and undersea bases, some of them along the Adriatic coast, at a depth of about 12 miles. The first, historical base was located under the area of Ascoli Piceno, a small town in central Italy, in the mountainous Marche region. Friendship gathers together various extraterrestrial populations that are different from each other, both as regards physical characteristics and provenance. There are friends from other universes and dimensions. However, all share a fundamental choice toward good. The population whom we personally interacted with is composed of individuals, men and women, like us, who are physically very beautiful, some about 3 meters, 9.84 feet. Tall, while others are tiny. What is important is what they represent, beyond the various typologies and endless folkloristic singularities. The Friends are not the only extraterrestrials who have come to the Earth. Individuals from various other populations are among us, because the Earth is a very particular planet inside the economy of this part of the universe. 2. There is, reportedly, an ongoing conflict between these species regarding the future of our planet. The humans involved, hand-picked by the aliens, were not cranks. Professor Brecchia, for example, was a retired expert in artificial intelligence and computer sciences, and has given lectures on didactical methodologies at the British Telecom Training Center, and on fractal analysis at the University of Novosibirsk and the Soviet Academy of Sciences. He was also a qualified pilot. Amicizia, he confirmed, included a psychiatrist, 2 cardiologists, the respected aerospace journalist Bruno Gibordi, the distinguished diplomat Alberto Perigo, who authored several pioneering books on UFOs, an archaeologist, some 20 engineers, several accountants, an expert in military logistics, bank employees, to members of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, 5 university professors, a court of assizes judge, the executive vice president of one of the largest multinational companies in the world, 2 future Nobel laureates, 4 generals, and a few politicians. 3. Others included Gaspar da Lama, a well-known Italian painter, and Professor Paolo Di Girolamo, a distinguished cartoonist I had the pleasure of meeting in Rome, who gave me a copy of his book in which his experiences are recounted. 4. The early Italian scene, according to Bruno Samasicchia and his friends Giulio, an engineer, and Giancarlo, an accountant, a series of poltergeist-type phenomena, including automatic writing of elaborate instructions, preceded initial in-person meetings with the aliens, which happened in April 1956. The group had been directed via a map to the Roccapie Castle, Fortezza Pia, overlooking Ascoli Piceno. Nothing happened on this occasion, although the group felt suffused with euphoric sensations of well-being and health. The following day, they drove to the top of the road leading to the castle. All of a sudden we saw some spots of light moving in the evening air, Bruno reports. We heard a voice, coming from nowhere, a very calm and strong one. Now, my friends, stay calm, because I am going to have one of us appear. Are you ready? Julio expressed concern that strangers might observe what was going on. Be sure that while our friends are with you, nobody else will be allowed to intrude, the voice explained. If they do, we will divert them. A man then emerged from behind the castle wall, followed by another. One of the men was very tall, the other very short. We were just in front of the main entrance, and they came toward us, speaking our language perfectly, reports Bruno. As they approached, we saw that one of them was more than 2.5 meters, 8.2 feet, tall, and the other about 1 meter, 3.3 feet, tall. The latter had a high-pitched voice, as dwarfs often do, but his body was perfect and his voice that of a man of authority. With very few exceptions, the aliens did not use names. For reference purposes, Bruno and his friends ascribed names to these and others. The tall one in this case became Sinus, the short one Seiju. They both shook hands with us, very gently, perhaps because they were very strong. We felt at that moment a strong sense of love. The men remained seated, talking with the aliens on nearby steps, the tall one some steps down, the smaller one a few steps above, for over an hour and a half. How many things they told us. That theirs was an important mission, that they had been here for many years, that he, Sinus, had been here three times, and that three or four centuries ago he had been in Central America, because in that area were bases operated by other aliens, perhaps the group featured in the previous chapter, who said they lived for up to 400 years. That there was a war, unknown to us. He said they usually keep to desolate areas where nobody could see them, so that they would not bother anybody, and at the same time they would not be bothered by anyone. They were perfectly aware of our history, our religions, and our philosophies. This earth was made for the good, but the men who inhabit it are transforming everything into bad, asserted Sinus. We are not here to conquer. We have nothing to conquer. Our interests arise from the fact that your earth lies within our stars, and so we are concerned with it. I do not live on a planet, but everywhere I happen to travel. This is a critical point in your history, a turning point in your technologies, but because of your childish enthusiasms you are forgetting your moral values. Everything arises from morality, and everything is done because of it. For this reason, we had, and we are still having, many problems with your people in the Middle East, and you two are going to be in trouble with them in the near future. The meeting ended at 3 o'clock. 2 days later, another meeting took place on Corlando, a small hill to the south of Pescara. The men had taken a transistor radio with them, via which the aliens were able to communicate by superimposing their voices over whatever was being broadcast. They also had the ability to make use of various gadgets with phenomenal qualities. One of these entered the ground in front of the men and disappeared. That particular place had been transformed into a kind of facility for us, explained Bruno. A subterranean base was built there so that when the men came to within 30 kilometers of it, they would be able to communicate with the aliens by telepathy. Other means to do the same, such as small rectangular metallic plates, similar in function to the one given to Richard Hogland, described in Chapter 11, and other devices, were also provided. Months of further communications and meetings ensued. 5. One night at the Ascalipiceno Castle site, Bruno and his friends, forewarned via the communication implements of an imminent contact, to include three of the craft and some alien newcomers, suddenly noticed that the sky seemed to change. In the distance, three tiny pinpricks of light approached. The ground under our feet started to tremble, so strongly that Giancarlo was thrown off balance and fell down, Bruno reports. It lasted some 15 minutes, during which Giulio took shelter inside the car and Giancarlo sat on the ground. They were almost hysterical. All of a sudden, two of the lights grew larger and disappeared. We realized that they were the spaceships we had been waiting for, and that two of them had already entered the underground base. The third spot of light just switched itself off. A few moments later, Gallurate, Sinus, and another alien appeared, together with an extremely tall one, calling himself Dimpietro, who they had also met before. The latter was over 9 feet tall. Stefano Breccia told me he once encountered him negotiating a corridor in Bruno's house in Montesilvano, bent double. Some others were even taller. We were happy being with them, continued Bruno, but at the same time felt a bit uneasy, because one could never tell what was going to happen when Dimpietro, a notorious practical joker, was around. All six of us sat on the ground. Dimpietro took a big cigar out of a box. He threw the empty box away, admonishing us to pick it up before leaving. Then he broke the cigar into 4 parts, keeping one for himself and giving us the other pieces. Then he lit the cigar with a flame coming out of his forefinger, laughing at us. In the meantime, some other aliens walked past and disappeared behind the castle wall. Curious, Bruno began to follow them, but was stopped by Dimpietro. Where do you suppose they are going? He said. They are entering our base. But I can't see them going in. Well, we like to be a bit spectacular at times. Does the door close after each one of them? No, it doesn't. Then may I go and have a look? You're welcome to. At this point Dimpietro picked up Bruno with one arm and Giancarlo with the other. When we got to the entrance, I saw an opening in the ground, like a vertical tunnel heading downward. I thought that the tunnel might have weakened the castle foundations, and, as if reading my thoughts, Dimpietro said, "Do you believe that we are such fools? We have taken care to strengthen the structures, so there is no risk." Dimpietro entered the base and bade Bruno and his friends farewell, bending down in order to embrace them. "Please, let the world know that we have come here with a great love toward you. You speak about love, but you do not know what love is. It is the very basis of life itself." 6. Inside the bases, in due course, Bruno and his friends were allowed to visit the base. Bruno and Giancarlo met at the appointed time in front of the castle and were told to wait. Giulio did not show up, having mistaken the date. They were told to go to the right side of the castle and to stop at a certain point in the pathway. "I started feeling the ground under my feet trembling," Bruno reported. "I feared that maybe there was an empty room under us, and that the ground was going to collapse into it, because of our weight." To the contrary, the ground itself opened, and another alien, Merdia, came out and told the group to proceed toward an empty area in the center of the hole through which they were about to descend. They were told to place their feet in certain areas where nothing was visible. "I did so," said Bruno, "and felt as if some invisible step was preventing me from falling into the pit. Then this invisible floor started lowering into the vertical corridor." Their descent came to a stop inside a huge subway with crystal-like walls, filled with the soft light. No lights as such could be seen, and they learned that none of any kind was used. "This place is filled with a peculiar radiation that interacts with the energy of the photons," explained their guide. The light was of a beautiful pale blue and the air very clear and scented. No shadows could be seen anywhere. 7. However, Stefano, who has been inside a base on many occasions, disagrees. "First, the shadows were colored, not dark," he told me. "And they were in different respective positions from the shadows cast by our sources of light. We have a main shadow, but their light comes from everywhere, so the shadows are distributed." 8. The group was met by Sinus and another man. It was a pleasant feeling, walking with these three friends of ours, inside that huge structure, Bruno writes. "I was feeling calm with a sense of well-being as I was breathing their air." He explained that the air was different from that available in our towns. It was full of negative ions, which were the cause of that sensation. He was told to touch his hair, and found that it was stiff and brittle, as though frozen. A result, he was told, of his being detoxicated. Via a viewing screen, the group was shown a room in which young boys appeared to be studying. Their height apparently varied from 2 to 2.5 meters. "For us, they are boys," said the guide. "One is 15, some are 30, and another one is 95 years old. Biological growth is slower than yours, but achievements are quicker." Many of the boys had short hair. They showed a benevolent countenance, Bruno continues. Some had brown eyes, others very light-colored green, blue eyes. They were of different races, and I was told that there are actually many different people, but that in most cases only their physical appearances are different, not their biological functioning. The group was offered a pleasant drink, made from a mixture of fruits, which apparently had a detoxicating effect. After learning and observing many fascinating things, Bruno and his group left the base at 3 o'clock in the morning. 9. No women were seen, though Bruno encountered them on other occasions. I've seen at least 6 women inside their bases, he wrote. They were really beautiful, and you could feel a strong sense of femininity emanating from them. Giancarlo once fell in love with one of them. Neither women nor men had a problem with nudity among themselves, though never among terrestrial guests. 10. Stefano related to me how, during the early 1970s, the W56, W from 2 VVs for Double Victory and 56 for the year it started, informed him that they had built a base about 975 to 1,300 feet in depth, directly beneath the ground floor apartment he rented at the time in Bologna. When they wanted me to come down, he said, they made a circle of light appear in the floor and the ground then opened up somehow and I was taken down as though in an elevator, with no visible means of support. Over a period of 3 to 4 months, I spent a lot of time at the base, at times sleeping there, having many discussions. In this particular base there were no women, though I think it was just coincidental. 11. Such is their technology that they are able to fabricate bases in a short space of time. Our friends were able to generate what they called a magnetic dress, that is a structure where the lines of force were strictly twisted around each other, Stefano explains. Such a thing had the property of opening matter, compressing it sideways, squashing it in on itself. Translucent, almost crystal, walls were the result, with enormous density, a Young's modulus, a measure of the stiffness of material, equally high, and of unbelievable strength. In this way they were able to open the cavities that would become their bases, evidently without damaging the surrounding tectonic structures, on the contrary, probably strengthening them. Such a structure remained stable while the fields that had generated it were active. It was sufficient to switch off these fields, a finger over a switch, to revert at once to the status quo ante. In a similar way, they opened passages to access their bases when needed, closing them immediately when no longer in use. Only very rarely, very small bases just under the ground, were stable corridors used. 12. Stefano informed me that the major W56 base beneath Italy exceeded 186 miles in length and 62 miles in width, with a 980-foot high ceiling. This huge base, he says, was not for living quarters but for the machinery essential for their operations. 13. In April 1972, Bruno, Giancarlo, and two other friends, Assad and Gustav, were re-invited to a base under the beautiful mountain chain of the Monte Sibillini National Park in Umbria. On emerging, the men found that several days had passed, whereas they were certain not more than a day had elapsed. Our friends then told me, he explained, that inside their base, gravity was 20% less than usual, therefore, one could move more easily, and the heart beats with less strain. 14. Telepathic induction. To what extent were the aliens you encountered telepathic? I asked Stefano. I know of up to 150 individuals claiming to be with Amicizia. I don't think they were telepathic. They said that, to produce telepathy, they had to use specific devices that were able to induce telepathic capabilities in human brains using a kind of implant. I have seen one of these implants, known as an Anya, and it is jet black, of a polyhedron shape. It looks like it's seeing light. It generates a huge quantity of reflective light, much more than incidental light. In the case of the W56, this object was inserted under the skin immediately behind the ear, and yet it dissolves into thousands of very small biological robots that disperse in the body. So you couldn't find anything if you looked with X-rays. Bruno had been implanted in this way. They asked for his permission before doing it, so he could receive telepathic messages. Once when we had invited him and his wife for lunch, and I had gone to pick them up at their home in a nearby village, during the trip back to my house, Bruno said, "I see that your wife is preparing something with mushrooms. Please tell her that my wife can't eat them." 15. Financial problems. On several occasions, the aliens asked Bruno to obtain literally tons of fruit and vegetables, and sometimes fish, for delivery to one of their bases. Bruno and his colleagues were told to hire trucks and drivers, ensuring that the drivers were never present when it came to collection time. The food was then collected by means of teletransportation and beamed to their bases. The drivers, having been persuaded to join Bruno and his friends at nearby cafes, could never understand how such a huge amount of food could have been collected so quickly. Payment to Bruno and others was sometimes by precious stones or, in one case, platinum ingots. On the latter occasion, at Bruno's villa in Montesolvino, the ingots reportedly just fell from the open sky into the garden, which when collected filled 10 boxes weighing about 150 kilograms. Luckily, Bruno was able to sell them to a wholesaler who didn't inquire as to their origin. 16. Bruno was asked by the aliens to build a large villa for them, under their guidance, on top of a high hill to the west of Montesolvino, beneath which they had a base. With 3 floors, it had many meeting rooms, large convention rooms, cubicles for individual study, and even a small observatory on the roof. They needed the property, they said, as a center of operations, to introduce new people to Amicizia and to develop some technical projects, and as a business enterprise. 17. When the W56 saga ended, Bruno suffered great financial loss as a result. "I had to sell everything," he explained, 2 buildings belonging to my wife, a couple of agricultural sites, and above all, I had to sell the large villa I had built, and in so doing I made no more than a tenth of its value, because I had to sell everything in a hurry. 18. W56 sometimes supplied Bruno with platinum and gold, Stefano told me, and, aware that the operation was costing us a lot of money, they once gave Giancarlo a device made by them which was capable of generating diamonds. But there were 2 problems. First, the device was absorbing a huge quantity of electricity from the cables surrounding the area, without any direct connection, so that people living in the area started receiving huge bills from the electricity company. The second problem was that, although the device was actually generating diamonds, they were in the shape of an ellipsoid 20 centimeters long and 10 centimeters wide. So nobody would believe they were real diamonds and they couldn't be sold. It would be too dangerous to try, because of criminals and so on. So one night, Giancarlo and I took a boat, went out a couple of kilometers from the coast, and threw them into the sea. It was an example of the aliens' inability to comprehend our situation. 19. What these aliens did provide, however, and in abundance, was a phenomenal amount of knowledge, inspiration, and, in many respects, protection for those involved with the Amicizia group. And it needs to be pointed out here that, on at least 2 occasions since 1956, they had prevented a nuclear war on Earth. They did so by transmuting the fissionable metals inside the warheads into lighter substances, so that no nuclear reaction could take place, Bruno was told. 20. W56 craft. The technology of the W56S was almost indistinguishable from magic. "Very seldom did they explain something," writes Stefano in a more recent treatise, their technology to be included in a second book on the Amicizia case. 21. Most of the time they made use of meutics, the Socratic mode of inquiry, serving to bring a person's latent ideas into clear consciousness, where a concept is not blatantly exposed to pupils, but discovered by themselves. Stefano learned that W56 and other groups use many types of craft, from small scouts to huge motherships. The scouts are not transportation devices per se, but mainly mobile laboratories, and even weapon systems. Surprisingly, they are made mostly of pure iron, though certain parts are manufactured from various alloys. "There is a peculiar field that connects all the pieces together," Stefano maintains. "When this field is switched off, The pieces fall apart, and the scouts are not stored in hangars. Thanks to their technology, the W56s ask their machines and robots to build a new scout when one is needed. Each time it is designed in accordance with its specific mission. When the mission is over, the scout is simply dismantled. That's why we see so many different types of craft. Each one of them has been built having in mind the peculiar activity it had been designed for. Scouts are not even always meant to be manned devices, many are totally automatic in their operations. And scouts are not always flying saucers, they may vary from an ELC earlier, less than a millimeter long, to crafts several kilometers long. Some scouts are not material craft, per se, but physical properties forced into a small amount of space. Stefano has ascertained that the propulsion systems vary from pure aerodynamics to magnetohydrodynamics to electrostatic or electrodynamic effects, to electromagnetic effects or to extremely complex sets of fields generating relativistic effects. These are what we call flying saucers or flying cigars. I do not know much about the latter. Of course, there are also differently shaped objects, such as triangles, squares, cubes, spheres, and the like. Usually the power source is an internal one. In flying saucers it consists of three or more objects, similar to cigarettes in shape and dimensions, but much heavier. They are called mother cells and produce a high-frequency current through their extremities. It seems that the intensity of electrical current flowing through the poles is astonishing, and one wonders how such a huge amount of current can flow through such small surfaces. What I do know is that it is always necessary to have something that absorbs the energy they generate, otherwise they could explode. A scout is never switched off, even in the rare cases when it is on standby. Thanks to their superior technology, no maintenance is required even in the long-lasting interstellar or even intergalactic craft that they use for their major displacements. Re the latter. Their propulsion system relies on greatly distorting the space-time geometry, requiring awesome amounts of energy that, in a kind of perpetual motion machine, the W56s are able to extract from the distortion process itself. There is no practical limit to speed, except the rapidity with which the internal computers are able to interact with the surrounding environment. That is the only practical limit, because operations depend heavily on it. Scouts, of mostly circular, sometimes elliptical, planform, flying saucers have diameters ranging from about 300 to 500 or more meters. The ratio between the diameters of the outer rim and of the inner cabin depends on several factors, and may range from, say, 1.2 to 10 or even more, explains Stefano in his treatise. Also, the ratio between the outer diameter and height depends on several factors, and may range from, say, 0.05 to 3. So, we may have extremely flat disks, or objects that we would not call disks because their height is much more than their diameter. In some cases there is no central cabin. Mostly, when no one is inside, no fixed portholes or doors exist. When one is needed, it is simply created, Stefano asserts. The iron can be rendered transparent, thus it is possible to create a porthole at will. It must be said that, most of the time, it makes no sense to look outside, because the outer disc prevents one from looking down. It can be rendered partially transparent, but that would interfere with the propulsion. A major problem, when flying low over ground, is that a scout encounters serious problems in acquiring information about its immediate environment. Therefore, in such circumstances, small devices are usually ejected that monitor the local situation and transmit the data back to a central computer. The control panel of a small scout is a rectangular area, which is very small, about 50 centimeters wide and 35 centimeters high. It is a touch panel, and it only ever shows the information that is required in the commands available in that situation. That means that its contents are continually changing, both owing to a decision by the central computer or upon a request by the pilot. Commands are activated by pressing the touch panel. It is theoretically possible to drive by thought, but rather cumbersome and therefore seldom applied. It is also possible to drive without the help of the central computer, but it is extremely difficult and occurs only when a new pilot is trained.